The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Means of Ascent, by Robert A. Caro. Continued, Cassette 1, Side 2. The shredding of the delicate yet crucial fabric of credence and faith between the people of the United States and the man they had placed in the White House occurred during the presidency of Lyndon Johnson. Until the day of Kennedy's death, until, in other words, the day Johnson took office, the fabric was whole. By the time Johnson left office, the fabric was in shreds, destroyed by lies and duplicity that went beyond permissible political license, destroyed so thoroughly that Wicker could write that the tragic irony of Lyndon Johnson is that the lowering of the presidency, not the great society of which he dreamed, is his most obvious legacy. We shall overcome, hey, hey, LBJ, the war on poverty, Vietnam, the great society, credibility gap. The presidency, 36th in the history of the Republic of Lyndon Baines Johnson, was a watershed presidency, one of the great divides in American history, in the evolution not only of the country's policies, both foreign and domestic, but also of its image both in the eyes of the world and in its own eyes. But it was not a triumphant presidency. Beside the bright thread, symbolized by the voting rights speech, that gleams through its tangled course, runs a thread much darker. Those threads, bright and dark, run side by side through most of Lyndon Johnson's life. In the first volume of this biography, a tall, gangling youth, humiliated and ridiculed during an impoverished boyhood in a tiny, isolated Texas hill country town that felt like the end of the earth, earns at 21 a reputation as a wonder kid of politics and rises with spectacular speed both to a seat in Congress and to a toehold on national power, in his ascent displaying not only a genius for discerning a path to power, but an utter ruthlessness in destroying obstacles in that path, and a seemingly bottomless capacity for deceit, deception, and betrayal. Once he was in Congress, these traits were accentuated rather than softened, but along with them there was displayed a rare gift for mobilizing the powers of government to raise up the downtrodden. When he was elected, in 1937, at the age of 28, the 200,000 farmers and ranchers of Texas's 10th congressional district had no electricity, and without it were living a life of terrible drudgery, a life almost as bleak and hard as that of peasants in the Middle Ages. His victory in his long, difficult fight to bring the lights to the vast Texas hill country carried his constituents into the 20th century. Johnson had displayed that capacity for compassion and for the accomplishment that made compassion meaningful before he was a congressman, in fact, had displayed it as a 20-year-old teacher in the Mexican school on the wrong, the Mexican, side of the railroad tracks in the desolate South Texas town of Cotulla. No teacher in that school had ever really cared if the Mexican children learned or not. He cared. Believing that speaking the language of their new country was crucial to their success, he insisted that his pupils speak English, spanked the boys and tongue-lashed the girls if they didn't, arrived at the school early and stayed late. And he didn't merely teach. He persuaded a reluctant school board to buy bats and balls and volleyball nets, so that, although these children had no lunch, they could at least play games at lunch hour. He arranged activities with other schools, baseball games and track meets like the white kids had. To encourage his students to learn English, he formed a debating team, scheduled debates with other schools, and managed to arrange transportation, since for the Mexican school there was no bus. His coming to Cotulla, one of his students was to recall decades later, it was like a blessing from a clear sky. As the story unfolds in succeeding volumes, the threads will again run side by side. As Senate Majority Leader during the 1950s, Lyndon Johnson displayed a genius for manipulation and domination for the sake of his ambition and for power for its own sake. He wrested from the Senate barons power no leader had ever enjoyed before. But he also displayed a capacity for achievement on behalf of the dispossessed, beginning to pass social welfare legislation for which liberals had long been yearning. And, of course, during his presidency in the 1960s, the threads run side by side, darker and brighter than ever. The two threads do not run side by side in this volume. The bright one is missing. For this volume is about a 7-year period in the life of Lyndon Johnson in which his headlong race for power was halted. These 7 years, the most extended such period in his adult life, begin in July 1941, after his defeat in his first campaign for the United States Senate. During the next 7 years, it appeared that he would never reach the Senate, much less realize the great ambition beyond the Senate of which he always dreamed but almost never spoke. During these years he lost his toehold on national power. And with the death of his greatest patron, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, he lost even the aura of a White House favorite. For 7 years he appeared doomed to live out his political life as one of the 435 members of the House of Representatives. It seemed that the highest goal he could ever reach would be the chairmanship of a House committee. These were years of hopelessness and despair, 7 years in what was for Lyndon Johnson the bleakest possible wilderness, a life without any political power that he considered meaningful. During these years, he came to the very verge of abandoning politics for a full-time business career, of leaving perhaps forever the world that was, in terms of his temperament and training and love, the world he was born to rule. Journalists would later write that Lyndon Johnson's years as vice president were the worst years of his political life. They wrote that only because they hadn't known Lyndon Johnson during his later years in the House of Representatives. During these 7 years, Johnson's lack of interest in the general legislative work of the Congress in which he sat, a lack of interest conspicuous since his earliest days in that body, became increasingly pronounced. And while he had previously done much for his district, had been not only a diligent and energetic but a creative representative, now, with his programs in place and being carried forward by an efficient staff, he implemented no significant new programs. In a state which returned its congressman to office for decades, there was no realistic chance he would lose his seat, and there was, increasingly, a lack of enthusiasm in his representation of his district. He had been interested, involved in work for the district so long as that work held out the prospect, the imminent prospect, of leading to something more. But his interest waned the moment it appeared that the work might have to be the end in itself. Without the lure of new, greater power, the power he possessed was meaningless to him. Lyndon Johnson's interest in governmental accomplishment will return dramatically later. Here, in the years covered by this book, it scarcely exists at all. These 7 years are years in which Johnson was all but totally consumed by his need for power and by his efforts to obtain it. So in this volume can be seen, stark and unadorned, the traits which were later to divide a nation. These years include the genesis of Lyndon Johnson's fortune. He had always wanted money, but so long as the path to political power lay open before him, the other desire had been deferred. Now, with that path closed, perhaps forever, the deferring was over. He grabbed for money as greedily as he had grabbed for power, and his financial rise was as rapid and spectacular as his political rise had been. At the close of the first volume of this biography, Lyndon Johnson had less than $1,000 in the bank. By the end of this volume, he is telling intimates that he is worth $1 million, a substantial fortune at the time. That growth, too, will continue as the story continues. When, in 1963, Lyndon Johnson became president, his family's assets totaled perhaps $20 million. This son of an impoverished father from the impoverished Texas Hill Country, who for most of his life had no stated sources of income except his governmental salary, entered the Oval Office as possibly the richest man ever to occupy it. But in this volume, in which we see Johnson almost 20 years before he became president, we can focus on the most significant aspect of his accumulation of wealth. The dimensions are small in relation to the wealth to come, and only a single entity, a radio station, is involved, while later that one station will become a radio and television, and banking and land and cattle, empire. So here we can pursue, in detail and without complication, a subject that has been endlessly discussed but little understood, at least partly because of the dearth of detailed information. The role and significance of favoritism and influence in a democratic government. The birth and early years of the Johnson financial empire illuminate very clearly the subtle means by which favoritism and influence are exercised, and their effect on other individuals and on the body politic as a whole. Throughout Johnson's entire political career, during the 20 years since it ended, the Johnson fortune has been shrouded in secrecy and surrounded by carefully cultivated myths. But although its foundation, radio and television interests, lay in an industry every aspect of which is regulated by a governmental agency, the Federal Communications Commission, no favoritism or influence was involved. That the fortune was not his at all, but his wife's, seeded by an inheritance she received and entirely controlled by her, that the fortune had in fact grown not because of any participation on his part, in response to inquiries made of him over and over again over many years, he stated over and over again that he played absolutely no role in the business, but solely because of her business expertise and hard work. that although the burgeoning of the Johnson fortune may have been helped by 20 years of favorable FCC decisions, no one was hurt by those decisions. In this volume, the birth and early growth of the Johnson fortune are examined, and under examination, the myths collapse. These years include the Second World War. Lyndon Johnson's 6 months in the United States Navy during the war have been treated with derision, as a story of opportunism or even cowardice, by detractors, and with praise, as a story of heroism, by supporters. But the actual story, as will be seen, is too complex for simplifications, and is strikingly revelatory of the violent contradictions in Johnson's character. And finally, these 7 years are climaxed by the election which, in 1948, elevated Lyndon Johnson to the United States Senate, ended his 7 years of despair, and thrust him back on the road to national power, an election in which almost 1 million votes were cast, and which he won by 87. His margin of victory in the 1948 election has been characterized as the 87 votes that changed history. And they were. The Johnson presidency was a watershed in American history, and without that election there would probably have been no Johnson presidency. But there are additional reasons to examine that election in detail. Among the many factors that contributed to the evolution of American history during his administration, Lyndon Johnson's personality and character bore an unusually heavy weight. To understand that history, we have to understand that personality, and nowhere are certain facets of his nature more clearly visible than in the grim struggle of 1948, Lyndon Johnson's last chance for political survival. During the 40 years since it took place, moreover, the election in 1948 for junior United States Senator from Texas has become a small but enduring piece of American political history. When Johnson became president and a wave of articles attempted to introduce him to the American people, that election was invariably prominent in every retelling of his career. Life magazine reminded Americans that an 87-vote landslide put him in Senate. The story of 87 votes that made history was a cover story blaring again from newsstands across the country. Years after his presidency, years after his death, that election remains ineradicably linked with his name. As Tom Wicker's 1983 article assessing his legacy explained, even had there been no war, it would not have been hard to distrust Lyndon Johnson. Hadn't he been elected to the Senate by only 87 votes? But the story of the 1948 election has been obscured by question marks. For 40 years, Johnson aides and apologists have steadfastly denied that the election was stolen, or have said that even if it was, the theft was only a standard example of ruthless Texas politics. But the fact is that although Lyndon Johnson, largely through the legal genius of his ally Abe Fortas, managed by a hairbreadth to halt a federal court's investigation into the stealing of the 1948 election, nonetheless he stole it, and in the stealing violated even the notably loose boundaries of Texas politics. It wasn't 87 votes that Lyndon Johnson stole to win in 1948, but thousands of votes, many thousands, in fact. Thanks in part to a manuscript relating the details of the theft of the crucial votes given to the author by the man responsible for the theft, in part to interviews with key figures in the election who had never previously spoken about it in detail, in part to the combining of hundreds of pages of transcripts of court hearings with scores of interviews, a previously bewildering picture comes blindingly clear. And there are yet other reasons for examining the 1948 campaign so closely. This biography of Lyndon Johnson is intended to be a study not merely of his life, but of American history during the years of that life. One of its focuses is the workings of the political power that shapes history, and in a democracy, political power comes ultimately not from a gun's barrel or a monarch's manifesto, but from a voting booth. Understanding political power in a democracy requires understanding elections. Explore a single individual deeply enough, Emerson noted, and truths about all individuals emerge. This is as true about campaigns as it is about men. Study a particular election in sufficient depth. Study not merely the candidate's platforms and philosophies and promises, but its payoffs. Study it in all its brutality. Focus deeply enough on all of these elements, and there will emerge universal truths about campaigns in a democracy and about the nature of the power that shapes our lives. Johnson's 1948 campaign is the perfect campaign to study, first of all because of Lyndon Johnson's genius in the art of politics. Election campaigns are the means to political power in a democracy, and in this campaign the means are used by a master, and can therefore be seen at their clearest and most effective. And it is perfect because of the man who was Lyndon Johnson's opponent in it. Coke Robert Stevenson has been all but lost to history, yet for decades he was, and indeed among Texans old enough to remember him he still is, a legend. He held the governorship of Texas longer than any man before him, and was one of the most beloved public figures in the state's history. In one contested Democratic primary, the crucial election in a one-party state, he carried every one of the state's 254 counties, the only candidate for either of the state's two highest offices, governor or United States senator, who had ever done so in the history of Texas. But the legend of Coke Stevenson was based less on his political triumphs than on his political principles, which included a deep distaste for politics in its meaner sense. He campaigned almost entirely in the style of the Old West, in which a candidate simply drove from one county seat to another, delivering a speech in each to a small audience on the courthouse lawn. Decades after Stevenson's 1944 campaign, in which, against eight opponents, he won the Democratic primary with 84% of the vote, still the highest percentage compiled by a gubernatorial candidate in any contested Democratic primary in the history of Texas. A leading historian of the Texas governorship wrote that that campaign was still unique. Perhaps no other product of the primary system ever has won, or for that matter ever will win again, the Democratic nomination with such a minimum of campaigning. The legend was based, moreover, on Stevenson's political philosophy, a fierce, self-taught Jeffersonian democracy made fiercer by the influence of the harsh Texas frontier. For whether or not that philosophy was suited to a rapidly changing 20th-century world, and as his gubernatorial record demonstrated, it had all that philosophy's weaknesses as well as strengths, it possessed a deep emotional appeal to Texans in its uncompromising belief in individual enterprise and self-reliance, in freedom of the individual, in a view of government as a necessary evil at best, and in a near reverence for the word conservative. Most of all, Coke Stevenson was a legend because of his remarkable life. Known as the Cowboy Governor, not only was he a true cowboy, his whole life, it seemed, was a Western epic, right down to the 1948 campaign, when, in an almost incredible confrontation on the main street of a dusty little South Texas town, Stevenson and his old ally, the renowned Texas Ranger Captain Frank Hamer, faced a band of Mexican pistoleros who had been ordered to prevent Stevenson from inspecting the disputed ballots that had taken victory from him and given it to his despised foe, Lyndon Johnson. Coke Stevenson was the living personification of frontier individualism, the very embodiment of the myth of the cowboy, a myth that still, today, reverberates through American culture with astonishing power. Because of the personality and philosophy of Lyndon Johnson's opponent, the 1948 campaign provides a unique view of the transformation of American politics in the middle of the 20th century. That campaign was the new politics against the old. Johnson was the new politics, electronic politics, technological politics, media politics. He didn't pioneer most of the tactics, except for one tactic, which had astonishing side effects, the use of a helicopter as a campaign device. But he brought some of these still new devices to a higher level of sophistication, using them to maximum effectiveness. Scientific polling, techniques of organization and of media manipulation, of the use of advertising firms, public relations specialists, media experts from outside the political apparatus, of the use of electronic media, in 1948, radio, not only for speeches but for advertising to influence voters, the mature flowering of all these devices dates, in Texas and the Southwest, from Lyndon Johnson's 1948 campaign. Stevenson was the old politics, the lone campaigner driving around a vast state speaking to handfuls of voters, no electronic devices to mediate between himself and them. Partly because Texas was changing from a rural to an urban state, mostly because the Johnson campaign demonstrated the effectiveness of the new techniques so convincingly that thereafter all politicians who could afford them adopted them, Coke Stevenson's campaign in 1948 was the last campaign of its type ever waged by a major candidate for a statewide office in Texas. It marked the end of an era in politics. Furthermore, regardless of its date, the Stevenson campaign was not merely the last of the traditional pre-media campaigns in Texas, but also as pure an example of that type as can be found. Coke Stevenson was not just the old politics, he was the perfect exemplar of that old politics. He was indeed what the historian called him, unique. The absolutism of Coke Stevenson's campaigning, the rigidity of his refusal to employ modern political techniques, made the 1948 campaign as complete a contrast between the new and the old as can be imagined. The juxtaposition of opposites throws into bold relief the essential qualities of each. Today, television sound bites and commercials make and break candidates, and substance fades all but completely before the power of image. But the techniques of mass media manipulation are employed by both sides in campaigns, a fact which, despite extensive analysis, blurs understanding of the impact and significance of this manipulation. In the 1948 campaign in Texas, these techniques were not employed by both sides. One candidate used them, to an extent unprecedented in the state. The other candidate refused to use them at all. And as a result, we can observe the impact of these techniques with a clarity that illustrates the full force of their destructive effect on the concept of free choice by an informed electorate. By studying this campaign, we can, on the other hand, hark back to an era in which public opinion was molded, to an extent hardly imaginable today, not by a candidate's media advisors, but by the candidate. The 1948 campaign was not only the new politics against the old, it was political morality made vivid, as political techniques were made vivid, by the sharpness in the contrast between the two principles. The pattern of pragmatism, cynicism, and ruthlessness that pervaded Lyndon Johnson's entire early political career was marked by a lack of any discernible limits. Pragmatism shaded into the morality of the ballot box, a morality in which any maneuver is justified by the end of victory, into a morality that is amorality. In the 1948 campaign, this pattern came clearer than ever before, in part because of the lengths to which Lyndon Johnson went in order to win, and in part because of the contrast between his extreme pragmatism and Coke Stevenson's extreme idealism, which makes Johnson's methods stand out in the clearest possible relief. The Johnson-Stevenson campaign was merely an election in a single state for a single Senate seat, one of hundreds of senatorial elections that have been held in the United States. But if upon close study, elections seem to blur together and to have only meager, larger significance, this election is an exception to that tendency, because of the sharpness in contrast between the philosophy, principles, strategy, and tactics of the two candidates. The clash of such mighty and violently contrasting opposites illuminates not only Lyndon Johnson's path to power, but some of the most fundamental ethical, moral, and philosophical issues of American politics and government in the 20th century. That campaign raises, in fact, one of the greatest issues invoked by the life of Lyndon Baines Johnson, the relationship between means and ends. Many of the ends of Lyndon Johnson's life, civil rights in particular, perhaps, but others too, were noble, heroic advances in the cause of social justice. Although those ends are not a part of this volume, those ends are a part of that life. Many liberal dreams might not be reality even today, were it not for Lyndon Johnson. Those noble ends, however, would not have been possible were it not for the means, far from noble, which brought Lyndon Johnson to power. Their attainment would not have been possible without that 1948 campaign. And what are the implications of that fact? To what extent are ends inseparable from means? Of all the questions raised by the life of Lyndon Baines Johnson, no question is more important than that. Chapter 1. Going Back. On June 28, 1941, Lyndon Johnson seemed to have victory, yet another victory, in his grasp. At the age of 32, he had already won so many victories, and had won them so fast. A tall, lanky, big-eared young man from one of the most remote and impoverished regions of the United States, the Texas Hill Country, a young man with no money and only a third-rate education, by 21 he was already known as the Wonder Kid of Texas politics. At 23, a congressman's assistant in Washington, he was the boss of the Little Congress, the Organization of Congressional Assistants. At 26, he was the youngest of the 48 state directors of the National Youth Administration, perhaps the youngest person ever entrusted with statewide authority for any New Deal program. At 28, plunging into a race no one believed he could win, he was elected to Congress. Now at 32, he was not only a congressman, but having restored centralized financing to his party's congressional campaign and revitalized the moribund Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee with money from Texas oil men and contractors to which he alone in Washington had access, he was a congressman with power over other congressmen, national power. And when, in April 1941, the sudden death of United States Senator Morris Shepherd opened a Senate seat, a paternally beaming Franklin Roosevelt allowed him to announce his candidacy in the ensuing special election from the White House steps, and Washington assumed Lyndon Johnson would be coming back a senator. The youngest senator, a senator at 32, well on the way to that vast ambition beyond the Senate of which he had spoken so frequently in his youth, and on not one recorded occasion since he had embarked on the road to it. All during the 1941 campaign, he assumed so himself. For the first time in his life, as week by week every poll showed him gaining on his leading opponent, Governor W. Lee Pappy O'Daniel, and then passing him and pulling further and further ahead, he was confident of success, euphoric in fact. As late as midnight on June 28th, Election Day, it appeared that the euphoria was justified. But on that day, Lyndon Johnson made a mistake. He hadn't made many, at least not in politics. If a single credo had guided his career, it was a belief that, as he was constantly telling his assistants, if you do everything, you'll win. He was constantly drumming that adage into his aides, and the evidence of his life indicates that he had drummed it into himself. For more than 10 years, at every stage of his career, he had done everything, had worked unceasingly, as one assistant put it, night and day, weekday and weekend. For more than 10 years, in addition, he had planned and schemed and maneuvered, trying to leave no stone unturned, cautious and wary at every step. But that day, after 10 years of ceaseless work and ceaseless vigilance, and after 10 years of victories, he had relaxed. In the very moment of apparent triumph, he had, for perhaps the only time in his life in a crisis, let his guard down and given his opponents an opening. Late in the afternoon of Election Day, the corrupt South Texas border bosses whose support he had purchased asked him when they should report the voting results from their counties. And he violated a fundamental rule of Texas politics. Report your key precincts, the ones in which you control the result, only at the last minute so your opponent would not know the total he had to beat. Otherwise, in a state in which not a few isolated rural precincts were for sale, beating it would be all too easy. With a steadily widening lead feeding his overconfidence, Johnson had loftily told the South Texas bosses they could report their vote whenever they pleased. They reported immediately, and late that evening, even as headlines were proclaiming his victory and his supporters were parading him on their shoulders in triumph as he whooped and shouted in wild celebration, O'Daniel's strategists were making quiet arrangements. The next day, sitting at a telephone with his face turned ashen at the news, Lyndon Johnson found out that he had not won, but lost. After 10 years of victories in this, his most important campaign, there was not victory, but defeat. Now Johnson had to go back to Washington, had to go back not as the youngest senator, not as perhaps the brightest star in the new galaxy that in 1941 was rising over the political horizon, but as merely the congressman he had been before. He had had the aura of the winner. Now he was going back a loser. So going back was hard. And going back was made harder by the unusually powerful hereditary strain, famous in the Texas Hill Country, that ran through Lyndon Johnson's family, the Buntons. Generation after generation, the Bunton strain had produced dark-haired men well over 6 feet tall, all of whom had strikingly similar and dramatic features. A long nose that jutted far out of the face, a sharp jaw that jutted almost as far, huge ears with very long lobes. Their eyes, vividly set off by milky, magnolia-white skin, were so dark a brown that they seemed black, so bright that they glittered, so piercing that they often appeared to be glaring. And the Bunton eye was no better known for its fierceness than were the Bunton pride and ambition. The phrases that hill country ranchers used about young Lyndon, that something born in him, bred in him, demanded that he always be in the forefront, at the head of the ring, were the same phrases that had been used about his forebears. Buntons possessed also a commanding presence and an eloquent tongue, that led them to try at an early age to realize their ambition through politics. Lyndon Johnson, born on August 27, 1908, had been elected to Congress at the age of 28, the same age at which his grandfather had won his first elective office. Johnson's father had won his at 27. And going back was hard in part because of the poignant circumstances of Lyndon Johnson's youth. When he was 13, his father's sudden financial failure had hurled his family, in what seemed like an instant, from a respected position in the isolated little town of Johnson City to what Lyndon was to call the bottom of the heap. The boy was condemned to live out the remainder of his youth in a continual insecurity that made him dread, month after month, that his family would lose the modest home that was all they possessed. Where once he had been able to charge more in stores than other children, now he could charge nothing at all, and had to stand watching while his friends bought candy because their parents had credit. The boy who, in the words of his favorite cousin, Ava Johnson, who grew up with him and loved him, had to be the leader in everything he did, just had to, just could not stand not to be, had to win, was now the son of a man who owed everybody in town, a member of a family held in contempt. He heard his father's acquaintances whisper as he passed on the street, "He'll never amount to anything, too much like Sam." And going back was hard because the insecurity and humiliation aggravated the already powerful inherited strain that formed the base of his complex personality. He had to be somebody. He had to be successful and appear successful. He had to win and be perceived as a winner. It was the interaction of his early humiliation with his heredity that gave his efforts their feverish, almost frantic intensity, a quality that journalists would describe as energy, when it was really desperation and fear, the fear of a man fleeing something terrible. Making the return even harder, much harder, was the fact that he not only had lost, but had allowed victory to be stolen from him. His brother, Sam Houston Johnson, said, "It was most important to Lyndon not to be like Daddy." And Sam Houston was correct. Their father, Sam Ely Johnson, was idealistic, romantic, rigidly honest. In wide-open Austin, lobbyists who dispensed the three B's, beefsteak, bourbon, and blondes, liberally to other legislators, learned that they couldn't buy Sam Johnson so much as a drink. His colleagues called him straight as a shingle, and despite his rigidity, he, an idealistic populist with a remarkable aptitude for legislative maneuvering, compiled an impressive record in championing causes against the interests, and for what he called, almost with reverence, the people. And the respect in which he was held by fellow legislators, decades later one of them, Wright Patman, by that time a powerful United States congressman, familiar with the nation's most renowned public figures, was to call Sam Ely Johnson the best man I ever knew, was mirrored in the adoring eyes of his son. As a small boy, Lyndon Johnson had tried so hard to imitate his father that people watching him laughed. He had tried to dress like him, right down to a scaled-down version of Sam Johnson's big Stetson hat. He tried to accompany him everywhere, right by the side of his daddy wherever he went. As a teenager, Lyndon Johnson resembled his tall father not only in appearance, the same huge ears, the same big nose, the same pale skin, and the same dark eyes, recalls Patman, who was to serve with the father in the legislature and with the son in Congress, but also in mannerisms, most notably in one very distinctive mannerism. When Sam Johnson wanted to persuade a listener of a point, he would drape one long arm around the shoulders of the man he was talking to, with his other hand grasp one of the man's lapels, and lean into him, talking with his face very close to the listener's. "Even as a teenager," Patman was to recall, "Lyndon clutched you like his daddy did when he talked to you." And when his father took Lyndon campaigning, Sam won 6 terms in the Texas legislature, driving from farm to farm in a Model T Ford, stopping by the side of the road to share with his son an enormous crust of homemade bread covered with jam while they talked quietly together. That was a time of which Lyndon Johnson was to say, "Christ, sometimes I wished it could go on forever." But it didn't go on forever. In the Hill Country, ideals and dreams brought disaster when they collided with the inexorable realities of that harsh land. Although, until Lyndon was 13, his father was financially successful, business was never what interested Sam Johnson. Texas legislators earned only $5 a day, and then only on days when the legislature was in session. But Sam was always available to drive endless miles over rutted roads, locating elderly ranchers who didn't know they were entitled to a pension, and helping them with their applications, or to lead long campaigns for better roads that would help farmers get their goods to market. his personal fortunes began to decline. And when, on a romantic impulse to make the whole Pedernales Valley Johnson country again, Sam, ignoring the realities of the worn-out soil and the marketplace, paid far too much to buy back the old Johnson ranch, he plunged himself, seemingly overnight, into a morass of debt from which there was no hope of escape. Always a little resented by Johnson City because of his air of confidence, the Johnsons could strut sitting down, and because he preferred discussing ideas and principles of government rather than crops and the weather, Sam refused now to change his manner, although he owed everyone in town, persisted in wearing a jacket and tie instead of work clothes like every other man in Johnson City, and resentment turned to ridicule. Ridicule climaxed by a roar of appreciative laughter at a barbecue when a potential political opponent said, "I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, Sam Johnson is a mighty smart man, but he's got no sense." Penniless, doomed to remain in debt until he died, unable to pay his bills in the stores he had to walk past every day, allowed to live in his house only because his brothers guaranteed the mortgage payments, he went to work on a road grading crew that was building the highway for which he had fought in the legislature, forced to wear work clothes at last. "He did a lot for that road, all right, Sam did," one man snickers in recollection. Lyndon's mother, also an idealist and romantic, who tried to teach her children that principles were the important thing, a delicate woman better educated than most hill country women and less suited to the rough life, was unable to keep her five children neat or even fed very well, and when she remarked, trying to explain the value of education, "Now is the time to put something in children's heads," the neighbors sneered, "Maybe she ought to try putting something in their stomachs." The Johnsons became, in fact, the laughingstock of the town. Lyndon Johnson was to spend the rest of his youth in a poverty so severe that often he and his brother and three sisters would have gone hungry were it not for food given as charity by relatives and friends, food seasoned with small-town sneers and cruelty. He had to stand in Courthouse Square and watch his high school sweetheart drive by with another man because her parents would not allow her to date a Johnson. "I saw how it made Lyndon feel," his cousin Ava says, "and I cried for him. I had to cry for Lyndon a lot." He was to work on the road gang himself, harnessed to a grader like a mule during a burning hill country summer and a freezing hill country winter. Lyndon's relationship with his father was transformed into one of resentment, tension, blazing clashes of wills, and competition as violent as admiration had once been. And this competition had one dominant theme. After his father's fall, it was terribly important to Lyndon Johnson that no one think that he had no sense. Sense, as the rough, brutal world of the hill country defined the term. Horse sense, common sense, practicality, realism, pragmatism. Not only did he not want to be regarded as an idealist or a fighter for causes, he wanted to be regarded as a man who scorned ideals and causes as impractical dreams, as a man practical, pragmatic, tough, cynical. He wanted the world to see him not as merely smart, but as shrewd, wily, sly. This was not perhaps a reputation that most men would have wanted. But, as Lyndon Johnson's demeanor proclaimed, it was the reputation he wanted, wanted and needed, because of the tears and terrors of his youth, needed desperately. Cultivating and manipulating older men possessed of power that could advance his ambitions, the young Lyndon Johnson employed obsequiousness and flattery so striking that contemporaries mocked him as a professional son. But that was no more striking than the openness with which he explained to them in detail his techniques of cultivation and manipulation, and boasted and gloated over his success in bending older men to his will. In both high school and college, he courted the daughter of the richest man in town. Not a few youths do that. Few take the trouble that Lyndon Johnson took, in both cases, to make sure that his fellow students realized that the principal basis for the courtship was not love or sex, but pragmatism. So widely did he make his motives known that his determination to marry for money became the subject of a joke in his college yearbook. Each stage of his political climb was marked by perhaps the ultimate manifestation of pragmatism in politics and democracy, the stealing of elections. At his rural college, where campus politics had always been so casual that the stealing of an election had not even been considered a possibility, he stole elections. On Capitol Hill, he arranged to have the ballot box in elections for the presidency of the little Congress stuffed with illegal ballots, and then, if even that was not sufficient to give victory to him or his allies, he miscounted the ballots. He did this with an organization that had been only an informal social club of congressional assistants, a group so loosely organized and insignificant that a later president would say in astonishment, "My God, who would cheat to win the presidency of something like the little Congress?" He was always secretive about exactly what he had done. No one could ever prove anything against him. But on both College Hill and Capitol Hill, he made sure with winks, hints, his whole bearing, that everyone knew he had done something. As one of his college classmates, a friend, puts it, "Everyone knew that something wasn't straight, and everyone knew that if something wasn't straight, it was Lyndon Johnson who had done it." And at every stage, at college, in the little Congress, in the big Congress, as soon as he was in the inner circle, he took pains to let everyone know he was on the inside, putting his arm around other insiders, whispering in their ear while ostentatiously looking around as if to make sure no one could overhear, strutting to display not only his power, but the fact that he had obtained the power by trickery. His attitude proclaimed that if there were any tricks to be played, he would play them, that if any outsmarting was done, it would be he who would be doing it, that no one was going to outsmart him. Until the 1941 Senate race, no one had. He had tried to steal this race, too, striking deals, buying county bosses, and he had, as usual, been unable to refrain from boasting about what he was doing. As always, he not only outsmarted opponents, but displayed a deep need to make sure they, and the public, knew he had outsmarted them. But this time, at the last minute, he had been outsmarted. He who had stolen elections, who had been confident he had stolen this election, had had the election stolen from him instead. He had been cheated of victory, as if he, too, like his father, had been only a man who had no sense. So it was hard going back. His wife, who knew how hard it was, says, "I'll never forget the way he looked, walking away to catch the plane to Washington, striding off, looking very jaunty, and putting extra verve into his step. It took a lot of effort on his part to act jaunty." That, she says, is a memory of Lyndon that I will always cherish. What made it easier was that he might not have to go back for long. The election for the full Senate term would be in July 1942, only a year away, and Johnson intended to run in that election. And about a month after his return to Washington in July 1941, he learned that if he ran, he would have a good chance of winning, for his great patron was his patron still. Men who had observed Franklin D. Roosevelt's reaction to other politicians who had lost after he had allowed them to use his name were at first unsure what his reaction would be to a defeated Lyndon Johnson. Johnson himself had observed that after his predecessor as Roosevelt's man on the Texas delegation, his fellow Congressman W.D. McFarland, had been defeated despite Roosevelt's endorsement, not only had he been unable to obtain even a low-level federal appointment, but he was never again allowed into the presence of the president who had once been so genial to him. But just as Roosevelt had, during Johnson's senatorial campaign, relaxed his customary strictures against campaign assistants in his efforts to help this young man, for whom his aides said he had a special feeling, so now his reaction to the young man's loss demonstrated that that feeling had not changed. After his defeat, Lyndon Johnson sent a note to Franklin Roosevelt. "Sir, in the heat of Texas last week, I said I was glad to be called a water carrier, that I would be glad to carry a bucket of water to the Commander-in-Chief any time his thirsty throat or his thirsty soul needs support, for you certainly gave me support nonpareil. One who cannot arise to the leadership shall find the fault in himself and not in you. Sincerely, Lyndon." In the margin of the note, Roosevelt wrote to his appointments secretary, Edwin M. Paugh Watson, "General Watson, I want to see Lyndon." This book is continued on Cassette 2, Side 1.